Okay, so we've covered the below ground with the earthquakes, and we've covered the above ground with the climate. Now I'm going to introduce Rick Thomas. Dr. Rick Thomas is head of strategy for the Willis Research Network and leads the Willis Re International Insurance Linked Securities Practice Group. In addition to that, he works closely with the Willis Re Analytics Forum to maximize the benefits Willis Re and their clients derive from the research and model building initiatives. Rick has 20 years of experience in reinsurance. His career began building catastrophe models with Cartograph in the UK. He moved to PartnerRe in Zurich and led the development of the in-house suite of catastrophe models that PartnerRe still uses today. In 1999, he began underwriting property cat business in Australia. I think I met Rick around that time. In 2004, he became head of the whole international property catastrophe book at PartnerRe. There, he ultimately became head of global risk management and reinsurance buying. After PartnerRe, he developed a detailed knowledge of the capital market space working with a US investment fund before joining Willis Re in January 2013. So very pleased to have Rick here today. Please welcome him to the stage.
Thanks, Will. I didn't really realize you're going to read it out in full detail with Willis Re in it. But anyway. I'm going to follow on from a very global talk, and I think mine's actually billed as being a global view, but I don't think I can get much more global. But my first slide just gives an overview of what we're going to talk about. And it's really talking about the science that's being done at the moment that really hasn't got anywhere near the catastrophe modeling space, that actually may well bring changes to what we do in the reinsurance industry and in the insurance industry. And you can see one of the big issues that's being talked about was global climate change, and one of the very important tools that's used within that space is actually global climate models. Also, I'm going to talk a little bit about what's happening with those models and how they're improving, and actually whether some of those improvements in resolution are going to really change the way we do things. So we're looking at, it's not just climate change actually, it's really looking at climate variability and forecasting, and also using those models to try and create event sets for catastrophe models. Is that something that's actually possible yet, or is it going to become possible? And finally, I'm going to talk a little bit about data capture and the new sorts of data that's coming into the space on the satellite data side and other new instruments that are used to capture data, and where that's actually not always a simple process. When we get new data, it doesn't always actually make our life easier. So I'm going to go in quickly first to the global climate models, and we've had a very good introduction to them, and I'm not the guy who runs these things, so I'm not going to claim to be a total expert on everything that's in here, but what a climate model does is it uses physics. It uses physics to describe the processes that are going on in the atmosphere. This slide actually comes from guys who work with one of the climate models, which is a UK climate model related to the UK Met Office and the University of Reading. It's HADGEM3. They have different resolution versions of it, and the resolution of these models is significantly improving since the last review, which is the Climate Model Intercomparison Project, and that's the CMIP-5, which you were involved in, which was in fact what sits behind the latest IPCC reports. So CMIP-5 was done with the climate models we can see here. Obviously, you can't read any of this slide. On the bottom, we have a list of climate models. And there's a lot of these climate models. And the reason we use a lot of climate models is they don't agree on everything. There's a lot of physics in them, there's a lot of different ways of putting that in, and there's a lot of different ways of forcing those models and actually building in sea surface temperatures and a whole bunch of other things. And you get different results and different performance. However, in this particular slide, we've got how well is the model doing at reproducing what we actually know. And so that's red is not very good, and these light sort of purpley blue colours. I really don't know why this colour scheme looks like this, but these blue colours are in fact doing well. And we can see that at certain things, and I'm even going to have to, I can read it here, I think, which is good. Things like precipitation, Actually, that's precipitation. And air temperature at various different levels. Actually, I was going to say those are doing well. But precipitation and those precipitable water things that everybody's doing well at. Whereas some models are actually doing quite badly at some quite important things, like air temperature, etc. So you have to put all this stuff together. And this was given to me by the HADGEM guys, this slide. So this shows that their model is a very good model. So the HADGEM model is there, and it does everything right. Now, I'm sure I could have got slides from other people who would have shown. I mean, CSIRO's model doesn't come out too well in this one. And I really will have to walk over there to point at it. It's that one there. But
the first column is the Australian climate model.
The first column.
And it's very, very good.
That one there. Yes, it is. That's true. Yeah, it's got lots of blues in it as well. So there you go. Yeah, I didn't see that one. Okay. Yep. These are right. So what we have here is, as I say, a set of different models, which together actually do quite a good job. So they're best together, they actually do a pretty good job. But what use are they potentially for us in the reinsurance industry? What might we want to do with those sorts of things? Well, one of the things we'd absolutely love to do is simulate the sorts of events that cause damage to us. And the sort of work that's been attempted with the models is extratropical storms in Europe. They're quite a damaging process. They cost billions of dollars, the extreme storms in Europe. So there's a team actually at, called Malcolm Haylock. Some published work on that. I think I've actually put the correct reference at the bottom there. Has used that to actually create an event set which is sat in a proprietary model that's used by one of the reinsurers. So that has been done. And how good are those event sets? They're good enough for people to believe that they're probably vaguely realistic. Now, I'm going to show you something that isn't going quite so well. People have tried to simulate tropical storms, and there's a lot of different ways of doing that. And you can do it by actually running the models, and obviously the resolutions we're talking about, which I talked about before, which is, I didn't actually specifically say, is quite often hundreds of kilometers in some of those CMIP-5 models. You can't really see very much detail in a tropical cyclone at that level. The eye wall scale or so on is normally less than that kind of scale. So you're not resolving very much. And when you directly model those sorts of things, you don't get intensities right. You don't really get intensities. So you have to do rather a lot of work. You can either downscale them by putting them into a regional model and trying to create them, or you can do lots of bias correction and come out with a set of events. And so what we've got in some of the attempts, there's been a lot of different attempts to do this, is you can actually look at what real storms look like. Here's some simulated ones, simulated using GCMs, and those tracks superficially look relatively similar. And actually, they look more similar than the ones produced by the commercial modeling of RMS. But when you get down to it and actually look at, in this particular case, and I could have put up many different cases, there's lots of groups who've tried to do this, and they're getting better at it. You can see that if this is looking at just the rates in various different regions, you can see that they seem to be predicting a lot more activity in Mexico than actually occurs, rather a lot more. So if we were going to use this as an event set in our CAT model, it would be drastically wrong, and we're not really there yet. And the next question is, will this next generation be better? Well, what we are doing is going down to resolutions that are producing storms that are close to the actual scale of the phenomenon we're trying to model. So there's a chance they will be. But I'm not holding my breath on that particular one. However, what they are getting better at, and which is actually potentially a game changer for the whole the way we look at risk, is they're actually getting better at seasonal forecasting. And we can talk now, they're getting better at forecasting some of this climate variability around things like ENSO as they're getting down to this higher resolution. This is quite a lot of it experimental still. We haven't got to a point where it's been fully peer-reviewed and actually got through all the science, but we're getting some pretty good hints that some of these things like, and so we know that we're heading into El Nino right now, and we know that it's going to make us probably, on average, if we look over the timescale, it's going to be hotter and drier in Australia, and we're not going to have as many losses as a result. But if you actually look at the seasonal forecast skill, you can actually turn your skill in forecasting some of that climate variability and the interactions between the different systems into predicting what you might see in terms of hurricane activity. And obviously, this is actually from work in the US at Princeton using the GFDL models. And the reference is on the bottom if you want to actually look at this in more detail. This is being done by the US government, but they are very interested, obviously, in their own hurricane activity in the Atlantic, but the model is a global model, so it's predicting activity all over. And this is just showing how well their predictions are working now in their hindcast mode, because they have to look at how well would they have worked over a particular time period. We don't know how well they work in the future, and that's where the real test will come. But they're getting a lot better at, in terms of hindcast skill, at producing not only how many storms will there be, obviously they got it completely wrong last year and they've no idea why, but how many storms will there be, but they also are hoping to be able to bring in some regional components to it. So we're going to be getting predictions that are actually reasonably reliable about where the storms will be and how many there will be, which is a big move on from what we've had in the past. You know, we've been able to sort of hide our heads and just be happy with the complete randomness and not have to face up to the fact that we might have a pretty good idea that next year, on average, the rate might be 30 or 40% higher in terms of losses. And it's a question the industry is going to have to deal with eventually, that we're not dealing with stationary processes here. We're dealing with processes that shift and have the climate variability element with a superimposed maybe 3 to 5 year cycle in variability. And in the Atlantic, there are some other multi-decadal oscillations which are changing the variabilities as well. So at any point in time, using a long historical record to actually calibrate the level you're using for your rates is possibly, or is arguably, not the right thing to do. And we're faced with this new information. It's actually causing us difficulties as well as, or challenges in how we have to think about the risk. So that's the forecasting there. The next phase I want to talk about, I mean, this is a sort of show off of lots of science, what's going on presentation. It's not, I'm trying to throw up some questions that actually might be hitting us in some places quicker than others. So the next part is really looking at, well, new data. New data, is it always wonderful and useful? And the point is, sometimes it is. Sometimes getting augmentation of existing data that actually helps us understand perils that we really don't have a lot of information about actually is good news. And it makes our models better. Sometimes when we get new data, we actually realize that it's not quite as good as we'd hoped. And sometimes it leads us to have actually big questions that we didn't have before, which are actually quite difficult. And I'll try and show you examples of all of those that are coming through at the moment. So the first one is looking at hailstorms. Some recent work that's been done in Europe, actually, at the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology has just been putting together hail climatologies for the whole of Europe based on a proxy for what's going on in hailstorms, are actually just using the satellite data on overshooting tops. So basically, when you have a big hailstorm or a big thunderstorm, you have these regions of cloud, I meant to use the pointer, that shoot over the top, and that's what you can see here in these pictures here. And those are proxies for where the storms are going on. You can actually track those and come out with rates at which, and here's actually the black dots are those sorts of things, compared with radar information, allowing you to get a picture of where the thunderstorms were happening that produced hail. Allows you to come out with a climatology. You can also improve your measurements again, and this is, again, the same bunch of guys who've got some wonderful little hail pads, which actually give you an idea of the kinetic energy that's coming in, and actually not beyond that. I think these guys built a whole network of them now around in this part of Germany, which is has been particularly prone to storms recently. There was a $5.4 billion of losses there last year in one set of events. So they're quite interested in hail, and these pads are actually giving them an idea of not only of the amount of hail that's coming down, which is a sort of traditional hail pad, but also the size of the individual hailstones, which is actually generally only something that's gathered in a very anecdotal way. People take photographs of the big hailstones. I mean, you guys have had some pretty big hail storms here. I think you all remember April in 99. So, you know, the big hailstorms there. But the actual data that you get for those storms is not as systematically captured as you'd like. So this sort of stuff is actually giving you major improvements in how you can model the vulnerability of various different components of houses, one of which actually very interesting in Europe is again in the same area, they've been increasing massively the amount of solar energy that they use. So everyone's got a nice solar panel on their house. They've also been increasing the amount of insulation they have. And the insulation goes on the outside of the house. And so when the hailstones come down, they bounce and make holes in the insulation and they smash the solar panels. So part of the reason it costs $5.4 billion is because they've actually been trying to adapt to improve the energy usage. Anyway. How am I doing for time? Just
8 minutes.
Okay, good. I mean, so, and there's a whole bunch of other satellite information that's being done, and Will really insisted that I put on a picture of a drone. he wanted me to talk about drones, but I don't really know very much about what these drones are doing, but at least they're being used for something fairly peaceable in this case. maybe not. I mean, flying into a hurricane is pretty wild, but at least they're... So they're gathering data, and that's something that we weren't really able to do. I mean, you had to fly those planes. And again, the history of looking at hurricanes has been an interesting history. Similarly, if we go back to looking at on the earthquake side, in terms of the scales and the ways that people have actually measured the earthquakes, the same problems actually throw up in any data set on hurricane intensity. Because before the 70s, we didn't have any satellite techniques for estimating the intensity of the cyclone. So there's a lot of direct measurements had to be used, and you didn't necessarily get all the direct measurements that you needed. And so there's a lot of inconsistencies, again, in the data about where hurricanes went. Even though there's a catalogue in the States going back to 1851, a lot of the data is very inconsistent over that time period, and there's a lot of incompleteness in the sense of how many of the storms actually happened and how many they were missing. So this is improving all those things, but again, you're going to have inconsistencies in the data record created by having that better data. And here's another example of something that looks like a very good idea when you start doing it, but actually turns out to be a little bit more tricky. I'm going to have to explain this slide in detail because, again, the text is quite small. But you can use satellite data now to get flood footprints. Okay, you get beautiful flood footprints based on the satellites. And Europe had a fairly rough summer last summer. They also had floods. And the floods that they had in the Czech Republic were largely associated with the rivers. And you can see that they caused, this is a satellite-derived flood extent. So the dark blue is what was visible from space. When a satellite actually went over. And the reds and then all these other blues all over here, nowhere near the river, or nowhere near the flood extent either, actually, as far as the satellite was concerned, are where the claims happened. So we thought, oh, wonderful, we're going to have this fantastic approach where we can spot the water from space and we'll know exactly where all the claims are going to be. It didn't work out that way because obviously some of the water wasn't visible from space. Maybe because the satellite wasn't there when it was happening, or more likely because the actual, you know, the size of the stream flows that actually produced these claims was so small that they wouldn't be visible. So although, you know, you can get good data that's really improving things, it's most good, and it spots the worst cases. These are the worst cases, they're all very near where the river was. There's a vast amount of off-floodplain flooding that doesn't get captured by that technique. So again, that's a slight drawback to the new data. And another interesting case, and this is an animation, so I just wanted to know how long we got for it. What's happening here is we have a picture of the North Island of New Zealand. And what we have is based on techniques that really only developed in the sort of early 90s. I think that the earliest work that I know of that was done using measurements of ground motion was in the late 80s, where GPS sets were as big as these chairs, and they had to be carried up mountains in Greece. And what happened is they just resurveyed Greece. And it had been surveyed in the early 1900s, and they resurveyed it, taking these big GPS things to each of the trig points, and they worked out how much Greece had moved and what shape and how its shape had changed. And what you're doing here now is much more modern. We have GPS data about where everything is in New Zealand, which is very, very detailed. And that GPS data is used significantly within the frameworks of deciding how much strain there has been. And in areas where there's a lot of tectonics, it's very useful for identifying which faults are actually moving and which aren't. And in fact, the very interesting thing is that, and I'm going to try and explain what's coming in the picture. What we have detected here is something we didn't really know about before. What we've detected in these colours is the ground moving slowly. So it's not creating an earthquake. So when it goes beautifully blue in this region and red, all this is moving, no earthquakes. And when we first saw this, it was, I remember, and you can check back on that one, was actually around Vancouver and in the Cascadia subduction zone. And the Cascadia subduction zone can produce magnitude 9 earthquakes. So when people saw this happening, they started to think, is this one coming? Is this what's happening? Is it starting to move and it's suddenly going to turn into an earthquake? It didn't. That happened about 10, 12 years ago. And there's been quite a lot of slow slip events on that subduction zone since. But we do not know really exactly what this implies. It might be strain being released or stress being released that actually will lead to a very benign outcome. Or it might actually be stress being transferred to the ground above these regions, which will actually lead to non-benign outcomes. We're going to need a few more years of these observations before we actually understand what's going on. So this is a case where wonderful new data actually makes the problem more complicated. But it's a very pretty, I love this animation. We could have had either this one, or we could have had the Cascadia subduction zone, but I chose this one. It's closer to home here, but it's also a very good illustration. Two more. Right. Well, I have got conclusions now, so we'll go for those. The two conclusions I want to throw up are really are both questions around. One's a question, and the other one is almost a warning. The question is: it's how long will it be before we actually have to really take seriously the fact that we have climate variability out there, and maybe on the earthquake side, slightly improved understanding of what's going on and forecasts that, related to changes in fundamental changes in the rates of events. How long will it be before we have to take that into account, and how will we do it? How's that going to be built into our models? It's not trivial. There's a sort of corollary to this that comes from, which is also very important, is that as a result of the variability in these processes, particularly on the climate side, the assumptions we tend to use about frequency of events, assuming that they're Poisson and that they're not over dispersed, actually are wrong. And this variability means that we should be looking at things either as mixed Poisson or actually coming up with some other distributions, which you guys normally work with, like the negative binomial, which actually take into account that over dispersion. And this is very, very important on the basis of aggregate losses and also extreme aggregations of loss in a given year. So that's just a side point. The final one is new data often takes time to understand. And if someone comes selling you a new wonderful bit of information that's going to solve all your problems, like those satellite maps, be careful. It might not always solve all your problems. Okay, so thanks.